Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for TWiT's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey. This is Triangulation, episode 192, recorded Monday, March 16th, 2015. Future Crimes. Triangulation is brought to you by HipChat. Collaborate, save time, and be more productive with your teams. HipChat is IM, video chat, plus file, code, and screen sharing all in one place. Invite your team members and get a free 30-day trial of the full version of HipChat at hipchat.com/triangulation. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you get award-winning financial tools, unbiased advice, and a transparent view of all your investments. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. And by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like dark chocolate pretzel pops. Wow! To get your complimentary NatureBox sampler, visit naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and spend an hour talking to them. I love doing this show because I get to meet people I'm fascinated by. And Mark Goodman qualifies. Not Mark Goodman, the MTV VJ. No, you didn't ever work at MTV, did you, Mark?
No, I did not.
Mark Goodman, former LAPD officer, street cop, worked as a futurist in residence. I love that, with the FBI, senior advisor to Interpol. He's the founder of the Future Crimes Institute and chair for policy, law, and ethics at the Singularity University. And his newest book, Future Crimes, I'll give you the subtitle. Everything is connected. Everyone is vulnerable and what we can do about it. And you're speaking, anyway, welcome, Mark, to Triangulation.
Thank you, Leo. It's my pleasure.
You're speaking to an audience that is probably more than most aware of how effective hackers have been, how effective criminals have used technology. And also, I think we're all very aware of how law enforcement has attempted to fight it. And it's a real tension between the two.
That's for sure. I think most folks hear about this in the general media. They hear about Target being hacked. They hear about Home Depot being hacked, Anthem Blue Cross. And they tell that story, as you pointed out, and I totally agree, your audience is very familiar with this subject matter. But the thing that the general public doesn't get is the fact that these are not isolated incidents. The media, the standard media, reports this as if, wow, look at just what happened. But yeah, the fact of the matter is, it's part of a new trend. This is the new normal. And the subtitle of the book kind of says it all. When everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable. And we're going to need to find ways to deal with that.
Who are these bad guys?
Yeah, it's changing, right? So in the old days, we used to think of kind of the war games, 17-year-old kid in his bedroom hacking away around the clock. And what we've seen is quite a change in who the hackers are. First of all, it's not just individuals. It's organized crime. It's governments. It's corporations. It's hacktivist organizations, like the Syrian Electronic Army or others. And on the hacker group, you know, back in the day in the 70s and 80s, when most people were hacking for the fun of it, for the lulls, to be able to show that they could do it just to prove that they could. Now it's actually become quite organized. And there was a study put out by the RAND Institute that I quote in the book that shows that 80% of criminal hackers are now affiliated with an organized crime group. So that's Russian organized crime, the Italian mafia, narcos in Mexico, a full 80%. And it's not those 17-year-old kids anymore. The average age of a cyber criminal today is 35.
Really? Well, it really is a different picture. Is it that organized crime is actively recruiting people with these skills? Where are these people coming from?
Yeah, they are actually. They're doing just that. So they're recruiting different levels of skill sets. So for those without many technical skills, they're being recruited in both knowingly and unwittingly as what are called money mules. These are the people, organized crime groups. They need to launder money. They need to launder their stolen goods. So they're putting ads on Craigslist and elsewhere. These are advertisements that say, work from your home, you know, in your pajamas. It's easy. Make $1 million. And what they're doing is tricking those people into opening up bank accounts under their own names so that they can do shipping and receiving or international monetary transfers, and they get 10% of the stolen funds that are being routed through their accounts. And so those people aren't very technical, but they go through them like crazy because those are the people that the cops catch, right? They're the weak link in the chain because they were tricked to open up the account in their own name. So they're relatively easy to catch. But even people with much higher sets of technical skills, we've seen organized crime groups recruiting at colleges, at universities, kids with criminal justice degrees to understand what law enforcement is doing, as well as computer science. And even on the drone front, down in Mexico, for example, and that's one of the big things in future crimes, is that it's not just the crimes of today, but it's where we're growing. And we're seeing a ton of development in drones and robotics. And down in Mexico, the narcos are actually going to the top civil engineering and aeronautical schools in Mexico, top graduates, kids who really know about aeronautics, and they're hiring them into their narco drug programs to build drones to fly narcotics across the border.
Holy cow. And the people who are recruited, are they, what's wrong with them? Don't they know what they're, is it just the fun of it? Or is it the lure of the money?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In the book, I talk about Crime Inc. and the concept of criminal organizations being run as startups. And the same people that are turned on by the possibility of a startup, make big money, be your own boss, you know, the excitement of it, beanbags, you know, in the employee lounge, that type of stuff. Organized crime groups today, modern organized crime, will resemble a lot of that. So a lot of people are doing it for the challenge. There are some people that are recruited into these organizations that work tech support, phone support, help desk. They're actually organized crime groups that have help desks. What they do is they put malware on people's computers and they pretend to answer the phone trying to fix it, but there's no fix, obviously. They just are keeping them on the phone so they don't call law enforcement. Some of those people don't know that they're wittingly or unwittingly participating in a criminal organization, but there are other people that do it for the money, and the incentives are great. Like, they will actually have employee contests where the criminal that comes up with the best hack idea or with the best scam wins a Lamborghini. There was actually a hacker cooperative that gave away a Lamborghini, suitcases with 50,000 euros in it. So the incentives are quite high.
And these groups are quite sophisticated. I mean, I'm on the site of the Syrian, you mentioned the Syrian Electronic Army, which is essentially, I think, a political hacker group in support of Syrian President Bashar. This is this is a sophisticated website. I mean, you're right. It's like, can you see this? It's like a startup. I mean, social media statistics, their Instagram feed, their Twitter feed. I mean,
yep. These are the people that hacked, by the way, the Associated Press about a year or so ago, I would say. And they've done everything from hacking, you know, all prominent U.S. media. They've done government hacks. But they hacked the AP Twitter feed, took it over, and actually put out a tweet about a year ago that said, you know, breaking news, explosions at the White House, President Obama injured. That went out over AP's official with the little blue check mark Twitter feed. And what was amazing as a result of that, and this is another way that we're seeing criminals become more sophisticated, is that bots react to that information. So one of the things I talk about in future crimes are both the rise of algorithms, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, and they're used by criminals. So in the case of the folks who hacked the Twitter account of the AP, when they put out that breaking news about an explosion at the White House, all the trading on Wall Street today, or the majority of it, is done by bots. It's all algorithmically carried out, as Michael Lewis wrote about in Flash Boys. And so when there's a terrorist attack, everybody sells. And that's what makes sense to do. So a whole bunch of shares were sold off. And 3 minutes, just 180 seconds after that tweet went live on the AP Twitter stream, the market collapsed. That lost $136 billion worth of market cap just from one wayward tweet.
That's really interesting because SEA would be theoretically a political arm, but it sounds like they could have done, they might have done that to make money.
They didn't in this particular case, but they certainly could have. And there was the flash crash back in 2010 where it wasn't clear what exactly caused that. So, yeah, there's tons of opportunities to manipulate the market. You know, people think when they think of cybercrime, they think about data being stolen. And as you well know from your own expertise, that's just the best case scenario, right? If you know that your data has been taken, okay, now we need to get new data. We need to figure out what happened. But the worst case scenario is that they change your data and you don't know what's going on. They hack your algorithm. They tweak it to do something it's not supposed to, whether it be on the trading front, your GPS navigation. All of those are algorithms and they're all hackable. Math need not be neutral.
Amazing. I'm intrigued by the fact that normal people could be drawn into this, as you said, with these Craigslists or the people who call. And I get calls all the time on the radio show from people who said Microsoft called me, said I was hacked. I've always wondered, or even the Nigerian 419 scams. You wonder how are they making money on these scams?
Yeah. Well, first, let me give an important safety tip to your audience. There are no princes in Nigeria that are reaching out to you specifically.
What?
Right? It's a nice thought, but no, it's not. They don't do that.
So that's a modernized version of a con. But now I'm getting the feeling that it might be more than that because of organized crime and hacking.
Well, yeah,
might be money laundering.
It's all of those things. And some of that money is even going to Boko Haram and some of the Al-Qaeda affiliates in West Africa. So cybercrime is funding actually terrorist attacks. So everything from the 2008 terrorist attack in Mumbai to the 3-7 or 3-11 attack against the Atocha train station back in Madrid all have a nexus to cybercrime because it's so easy to commit. The chances of getting caught are so low. And so they're using that to fund some of their operations. But back to the West African Nigerian fraud, a lot of that is being carried out by the so-called Yahoo boys that do nothing but work in cyber cafes in West Africa. And they make a ton of money and they are incredibly sophisticated at it. And, you know, it's avarice that drives this. People want to believe that they were the one that was selected by the Nigerian prince. To your point, by the way, about crowdsourcing this and hiring folks into their operation and future crimes, I tell the story of the Craigslist bandit. I'm not sure if you remember that one, but the guy who robbed the bank up in Seattle.
No, tell me the story.
So it's a great way. Criminals are using both crowdsourcing and crowdfunding. So whatever the latest techniques are in Silicon Valley, they are all over them. So here's an example of crowdsourcing a bank robbery. A guy goes into a Bank of America, I believe it was, in downtown Seattle, and he points a gun at the teller, gives her a note, and says, all right, this is a stick-up. She gives him all the money, the guy runs away, and she dials 911. The police say, what did he look like? They said, oh, he was a male white, about 6 feet. He had on a construction worker's helmet. He had on construction goggles. He was wearing an orange safety vest. He had a tool belt, blue jeans, work boots, and he ran out. Okay, don't worry, the cops say in Seattle, we're on our way. The cops start driving up to the bank, and what do you know? They see the guy right there. They see the construction worker. So like, freeze, put your hands up.
They see
custody. Then another police car comes. They take another construction worker into custody, and before you know it, they have like 20 members of the Village People.
It's a flash mob.
A flash mob. What the bank robber did before he carried out his bank robbery is he put an ad on Craigslist and it said, wanted construction workers. I'll pay $50 cash, be at the corner of 3rd and Main in downtown Seattle at precisely 11 a.m. Note, you must have your own work boots, blue jeans, tool belt, orange safety vest, goggles, and helmet. And so unwittingly, these people that were looking for work just showed up and helped crowdsource his escape.
Did they ever catch him?
They did eventually, yeah. Through DNA evidence.
I don't even want to know why there was any DNA evidence at the bank site.
Yeah. You touch the counter and things
right,
like
that. Right, okay. Skin sheds. Okay.
Yes.
We're talking with Mark Goodman. He's the author of Future Crimes. I want to talk a little bit about the Internet of Things and what new opportunities that opens up for cybercrime. And let's also say that we're going to talk about solutions as well. Because,
yes, absolutely.
I don't want to make people scared and paranoid. I think that there's solutions to this, but we'll get to that in a second.
The last three chapters of the book, I cover the solutions.
You're positive. Yeah, yes. You don't leave us hanging.
No.
And I want to talk about RoboCops, too. I know that's your the subject of your
next
book.
I can talk
book.
About criminals using robots and cops using robots.
Oh, my God. there was a protest, I think, this morning against robots at South by Southwest. They had protesters going, when I say robots, you say no bots. So there's an anti-robot movement, I think.
It's starting.
It's growing.
And AI as well, right?
We see we're
Elon
scared.
Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking all coming out against artificial general intelligence.
We've had a number of guests on that subject, and that's another scary topic. We'll have more with Mark Goodman. His book, Future Crimes, is just out from Doubleday, and it's a great read. A lot of fun to read. Our show today brought to you by HipChat. We use HipChat all the time. In fact, we started using HipChat with our Austin, Texas web design team because they're in Austin. We're here. They always have questions. We're always on. I live in HipChat because it runs on all my computers, Mac, Linux, Windows. Even on my Chromebook, I use the web-based version of HipChat. Now we've started using HipChat. I should log in. We have HipChat for every part of the company. What is HipChat? Well, initially you might look at it and say, oh, that's IM, but it's so much more than just instant messenger. It's a way for teams to work together, and it is fantastic. It's video chat, it's instant messenger, it's document sharing, it's screen sharing, it's code sharing. I think a lot of people started using HipChat as programmers. Let me log in if I can while I'm talking. I can't do it. All right, there we go. I'm going to log into my HipChat here real quickly so you can see how we use HipChat. We have a very active HipChat room. It is also fun, which is important. Look how many Twit TV rooms we have. Engineering, i5, Monday TNT, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday TNT, Mobile World Congress, Barcelona, News Team, Post-Production. There's a little hint there. There's some stuff we're working on. We have special HipChat rooms. Just for that, it's fantastic because it keeps people in a real-time collaboration. Email's kind of too slow and asynchronous. Meetings, don't get me started on meetings. It's better than regular instant messenger because it plays nice with all sorts of other things, 57 different services like GitHub and Jira, Zendesk. They've got a little tool called Linky. You see it right there where when you put a link in, it shows you a preview. It's just great. We love HipChat. You will, too. That's why we've set up a special deal for you. There's a freemium version of HipChat. You can use that free forever. But we decided to pay for HipChat because you get so much more. The full version of HipChat includes the bonus features of video and screen sharing, lots of others. You can try HipChat free, no credit card required. If you go to hipchat.com/triangulation, sign up, click on start chatting, invite a few team members, 30 days free. And I'm going to sweeten this a little bit for the first 100 of you who respond right now. We'll get you 90 days free. We can only do that for the first 100, though. HipChat.com/triangulation. We've had a really found a lot of use. One, two, three. I mean, there's like 15 HipChat rooms now that we're always in, always going. It's wonderful. It's very, very useful. We are talking about the future and the present, frankly, of cybercrime with Mark Goodman. You know, we used to do a show on Tech TV called Cybercrime. And we've come a long way in the 10, 15 years since. And partly that's because technology and the internet are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And so you're saying that this really gives a criminal an opportunity. What about the Internet of Things? It's now going to be my thermostat and my garage door. Is that going to – about that?
Yeah, it's more opportunities. I say the Internet of Things is just the Internet of Things to be hacked, right?
Yep.
It's more opportunities to go after stuff. And as we transition from Internet Protocol version 4 to Internet Protocol version 6 with like 78 octillion possible connections, things live online, every physical object is transforming itself into an information technology. So the car today is not like that 65, you know, Chevy that is a computer on wheels, right? A car is a computer that we ride in, an elevator's a computer that we ride in, an airplane's a Solaris box that we fly in, and a pacemaker is a computer that we get implanted in our chest. So we're seeing every physical object with the Internet of Things will be connected via RFID, Bluetooth, near field communication. And already criminals are making progress in hacking those things. They're hacking smart refrigerators. I write about in Future Crimes an example of a whole series of refrigerators that were brought into a botnet. Right. So they were connected to the Internet. They're part of a botnet. DVR is part of a botnet. We've had apps in the Google Play Store that have had malware in them that are causing your phone to mine Bitcoin in the background for other people.
MicroTorrent has had a BitTorrent Bitcoin miner built in. Yeah. People, you know, we're running it as a BitTorrent client and at the same time making a little money on the side.
Exactly. Use those extra computing cycles. So everything from implantable medical devices are going to be hackable. Robotics are hackable. We'll see bionic skeletons and the like. All of that stuff, plus all the smart things, you know, whether it be the smart thermostats, smart fire alarms, all of that can be hacked and has been hacked. And people forget the Target hack that occurred two Christmases ago, how the bad guys got into the Target network. And I'm sure you know, but it was via the air conditioning system.
Yeah.
So Target centralized their HVAC system.
It was the HVAC company had a login to the Target stuff. It wasn't like the air conditioning had bad
Not
guys in it.
Not the specific air conditioning, but they sent a spear phishing email and they were connected to the
network. Spear phishing is a big technique where it's targeted malware email. In fact, isn't that how the Sony Pictures Entertainment hack began back in May?
Yep. They went after a whole bunch of people at Sony that were part of the IT team. And in Future Crimes, I actually tell the story of an executive at Coca-Cola who got spear-phished. They were doing a deal with the Chinese and with a Chinese beverage company, state-sponsored beverage company there. And they targeted the CFO of Coca-Cola. And they knew, because they had studied him for so long, how he communicated, what nicknames he used. They sent out an email that looked as if it came from the CEO, spoofed it. He clicked on it, they infected it, and I think Coke lost out like on a multi-billion dollar deal as a result of them being able to steal that information. So they're getting much, much better with this.
And on the other side, we've seen state-sponsored malware like Flame and Stuxnet that is kind of brilliant and brilliantly done. Obviously, the NSA and others have hired the best hackers they can find and are creating their own malware and raising another issue because when you put this stuff out there, as with Stuxnet, you target it. You hope it's only going to hit the Iranian uranium centrifuges,
right?
But it can escape, and in fact, Stuxnet did.
It did. And by the way, it's a little bit different. When you target a country with kinetic ordnance, like you're going to drop a bomb on this country or that country, when you drop the bomb, it explodes. When you toss malware over the fence and target it at somebody, it doesn't explode. It doesn't go away. And that's what we've seen with Flame and Dooku and other sons of Stuxnet, is that people can take that code, work on it, and use it themselves to create criminal versions of what were state-sponsored cyber weapons. So I talk about the so-called malware industrial complex in Future Crimes, where I take people into that world and show what it's like and how much money you can make by buying and finding those zero days.
The malware industrial complex.
Yes, the new military industrial complex based upon malware.
I was a little disappointed. A good friend of mine, Kevin Mitnick, when he got out of jail, we had Steve Wozniak on the Screensavers. His first time on the internet, Woz gave him a MacBook and he got on the internet. Love Kevin, great guy, but I'm a little disappointed to have learned just recently he started selling zero-day exploits. It's probably a pretty good business.
It's an excellent business, you know, and there's a mismatch of incentives. In the old days, if hackers brought malware or zero days to the attention of the companies who were making our operating systems, the traditional response was to arrest these people.
Right.
So if you were a white hat or a gray hat and you brought something to Microsoft and said, hey, here's this bug, either they would ignore the hackers or they would send them off to jail because they'd call in the Secret Service or the FBI.
Sure.
Now they're getting a lot smarter and they're starting to pay. But if you can make, you know, $100 or $1,000 by selling your zero day exploit to a software company, or you can make $100,000 on the black market selling it to a nation state, then people are obviously going where the economic incentives drive them.
This has caused some inflation, I know, because Facebook and Google are now paying a lot more for bugs, bug reports, than they used to. And I guess this is why, right?
Absolutely. They need to be competitive.
Yeah. Who's winning this war? It seems like it's a seesaw war, but I have to say, and maybe it's because we do Security Now each week with Steve Gibson, so I hear all the bad stuff. It feels like the last 2 or 3 years, the hackers have started to win.
Yes, that's my strong impression. I got involved in this almost 20 years ago, and I start off telling the story in Future Crimes of how I got drafted into cyber policing. I was working as an investigator with the LAPD, and my lieutenant screamed my name across the detective squad room. He was like, "Goodman, get your ass over here." I'm like, "Okay, I'm in trouble." I go, "Yeah, boss, what's up?" He says, "I got a question for you. Do you know how to spell check in Word? Perfect." And I said, "Yeah, Shift F2. And he goes, "I knew you were a geek. I got a case for you."
Oh, so my God. That's what did it.
Look at the prologue of Future Crimes. I could spell check. That put me at the techno elite of policing. So that's how it was back in the day. So law enforcement is making strides. But one of the things that most people don't realize is the internet broke policing. Policing used to work really well in our physical geographic space. If you rob a bank in San Francisco or New York, it all worked perfectly. You had the victim bank in New York. You had the criminal in New York. You had the police or FBI in New York. You had your evidence in New York. Everything was co-located. But now with the internet, you've broken that co-location. And the challenge is that an NYPD officer or an FBI agent can't make an arrest in Moscow or in Lagos. So the criminals can cross these borders automatically, and the cops have no ability to do so. They have to rely on mutual legal assistance treaties and things like that. And it can take years to get evidence. Back when, you know, if I was working as a detective and wanted to get evidence from a French computer, I need to fill out a form that went from the LAPD to the LA County Sheriff to the California Department of Justice to the U.S. Department of Justice to the FBI to the State Department to the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the French Ministry of the Interior. That could take 2 years, and an IP address can be changed in seconds. So the two systems are fundamentally mismatched, and I don't think people understand that, is that we're never going to arrest our way out of this problem. This is getting more into the solutions, but we use the language of medicine to describe the problem. We talk about cyber threats,
viruses, infections,
all of that stuff. So we use the language of medicine to describe the problem, but we don't use the tools of medicine, public health, epidemiology and the like, to solve it. And I think there's so much that we can learn from biomimicry and other tools in epidemiology. So the goal shouldn't be to arrest the guy with measles. It should be to isolate the person with measles or Ebola, make sure they don't affect other people, treat them as necessary, but protect the greater good. And I think that'd be a much more effective model.
I think you're right. That's a really a great way to talk about it. We're talking to Mark Goodman. He's the author of Future Crimes, brand new from Doubleday. Everything is connected. Everyone is vulnerable. And we're going to get to what you can do about it. As hackers are getting better and more effective, opportunities are growing exponentially.
Very much so.
Is law enforcement getting smarter? Hopefully. You can be honest here.
They are lovely people. They are my brothers and sisters in blue. It's not a question of smartness. It's the fact that they're fighting a fight with their, you know, legs tied together.
How can they keep up? I mean, are we recruiting the smartest mathematicians to be a LAPD forensics?
Right.
No.
So, right. And look at the salary, right? Would you rather work at Google with the free cafeteria and the great benefits and the shares and, you know, the Google bus that takes you to work? Or do you want to start out at $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year as a street police officer? So obviously, it's very difficult for the government to bring in these cybersecurity professionals. Cisco Security put out a study that says we currently have a shortage of 1 million cybersecurity professionals. It's going to grow to 2 million in just the next few years. So there's a critical shortage. And you have to be motivated by patriotism or community service or something else to want to go work in these organizations. And even once you're there, even if you're well-trained, well-educated, and well-intentioned, the bureaucracy can be quite challenging at times trying to get stuff done. Everybody sees these shows, you know, these CSI shows, a bicycle is stolen and 50 FBI agents show up with their blue lights and they're looking for evidence. And it doesn't quite work like that in real life. So the bad guys are out there, and they're using all the same tools. They're using artificial intelligence. They're playing with synthetic biology. They're all over robots and drones. And they're official, like, organizations. They have HR departments that hire these mules. They have quality assurance departments. So there's QA that audits malware code before it goes out the door. Yeah, they'll test it against 250 different AV products to make sure that it's not picked up. So they've got quality assurance. They've got HR. They have employee benefits. They have all of these departments, SEO, that will go out there and make sure that they show up high on the internet. And then on the digital underground, once you get into the dark web and the deep web, the Silk Roads of the world, incredibly sophisticated in terms of how they run their operations and the amount of money that can be made. $500 million, $1.2 billion was alleged in the case of Silk Road. That's how much business they did. You know, Dread Pirate Roberts or Ross Ulbricht, allegedly his personal take was $110 million. So there's some pretty good money here.
What do you think is the greatest threat right now? Is it Bitcoin? Is it the dark net? Is it what should we really be? Where should we be looking for the next big thing?
I think there's a few different areas that are developing. I'll talk about one that's kind of near term, one medium term, and one that's slightly longer term. In the near term, I think that the thing that people don't get is that they think criminals, human beings, are committing crime. But the big shift that occurred, and it started about 10 years ago, is that crime became software. It's crimeware. When I was working with Interpol down in Brazil, we had a case where we saw people selling DVDs in one of the favelas outside of Rio, and we thought they were pirated movies, but in fact, it wasn't pirated movies. It was computer malware, right? It was
no.
A whole self-contained identity theft kit, and you would buy the software. So you didn't need to be a master hacker. The master hacker created software that would do identity theft. And what was awesome about it is the more you bought, you could get bulk discounts, right? So this was crimeware, software that committed crime, and they even came with service-level agreements. So we guarantee 85% of our stolen credit cards will work or your money back. And my favorite part is they actually had tech support, like 800-number tech support. So if you're a less savvy cyber criminal, you could call up like the 800 number and say, hey, I'm trying to commit identity theft, and it's not working. And they would say, well, sir, have you tried rebooting your computer, right? So all of the stuff that you see in the real world is in the criminal world too. So we have crime where we had software as a service. Now we have crime as a service. There are tools out there like Blackshades for a few thousand dollars that will do keystroke logging, infect USB drives, do camera hijacking, ransomware. So it's a fully contained crime kit. It's like a startup kit, and you become, you know, a franchise that can go out there and commit crime. So the challenge of that and the difference that we're seeing now, and the thing that I think most folks don't get, is that the human being that used to be at the keyboard and typing is disappearing into the background, and that most of the attacks today are automated, which means that they scale. You were talking about exponentials earlier, right? We have entered the realm of exponential crime. Robbery used to be a one-on-one affair, but now one kid in Moscow can go ahead and rob 100 million people or take over 100 million accounts at Target or Sony PlayStation. So crime is scaling, and it's scaling exponentially. So we've got the crime bots. The challenge is we don't have the cop bots. We don't have anything to go after them that's sophisticated enough today. And so that's one of the big challenges, is that I'm seeing criminals automating crime, which means it's scale. I often hear people say, well, why would cyber criminals come after me? I've got nothing to hide. And what they don't understand is they're not coming after you. They're coming after everybody. It's basically because they can write code that will go up and open everybody's front door and try to check the windows and see if they can get in. So crime has become software.
I'm going to ask you to kind of lead us through, give us an example of kind of a whole scenario, you know, from start to finish of how this might work with botnets and all the little tricks of the trade. But I'm going to take a break before we do that.
Sure.
Mark Goodman is our guest. He's the author of Future Crimes and talks about all of this. And as he said, the last three chapters are for giving you hope. But at this point, I feel pretty hopeless. Our show today, brought to you by, actually, this is something really important for everybody to know about, Personal Capital. Bill Harris was our guest on Triangulation 2 years ago. He didn't talk much about Personal Capital. He just founded it. But afterwards, he told me about it. And I said, can I sign up for that? He said, sure, you'll be one of our first customers. I've been using it for 2 years, and I love it. It's hard to describe because it does several different things. It starts, and this is where you should start, very simply by going to personalcapital.com/triangulation. and set up your personal financial dashboard. It'll just take a few minutes. You're going to set it up with all of your accounts, your investment accounts, of course, but also your bank accounts, your credit cards. Now, don't worry. We were in the middle of a security conversation. You're using the back end that most of the banks use for the exact same thing. You're not giving anybody information like personal capital information that they could use against you. It's very secure, very safe. As I said, I've been using it for 2 years, and I love it. What you'll get immediately is a dashboard that tells you where your money is, how it's working. It's always up to date. It's a real-time dashboard. It's on your computer, on your tablet, on your phone, even on your Android Wear watch, which is pretty fantastic. So you'll now know, you'll be able to make smarter financial decisions. You'll now know your net worth. For some of you, that might be the first time you've ever seen a number like that. You'll know where your money's going. It'll help you budget. If you put in $100,000 or more in assets at Personal Capital, then you can take the next step. Because one of the things you want to know is, where is my retirement planning going? Where are my investments going? Am I losing money through commissions or fees on my 401k that are shaving years off my retirement? They can help you with that. For a free 30-minute review with a Personal Capital financial advisor, these are non-commissioned, certified financial planners, you could discuss your financial goals, your risk tolerance, your time horizon, plan your retirement. These 30 minutes will make, could add years to the amount of time you can retire. I mean, it's really fantastic. And all you have to do is put $100,000 worth of stuff, assets, in your Personal Capital dashboard. You can also use Personal Capital. The third way to use Personal Capital is as a broker, you have an investment advisor. You could put money in a Personal Capital account. So all three of those are available. It starts with the free, simple, easy-to-use dashboard. You can use that free forever. They won't hassle you. They won't bug you. I've been using it for 2 years, and I love it. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. And get a free no-obligation portfolio consultation if you link $100,000 or more in assets on your dashboard. It's very easy to do. And I'll tell you, the results will benefit you for the rest of your life. You'll have that free 30-minute portfolio consultation when you set up that free account at personalcapital.com/triangulation. Ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is the way to running out of money when you're 75, and that's not good. I can promise you Social Security won't keep you going. personalcapital.com/triangulation. Mark Goodman, our guest, Future Crimes, the topic. And anybody who's listened to Twit for any length of time has listened to Steve Gibson. We know that all the amazing thing bad guys are doing, but I think it might be useful just to kind of walk us through one kind of hack, because I think sometimes it's kind of obvious what the hack is, but it's not obvious why they're doing it and what they get out of it. Can you give us a scenario so we can understand
sure.
it better?
Of course, most of these hacks occur for money. There are some that occur for revenge. The whole revenge porn thing has been going on for a while. Yeah. There are some that where people are exploiting minors. So there's those type of sexual crimes against children. But for the most part, they occur for monetary purposes. And it's just because there's so much money to be made. As I said, you know, the Silk Road, $1.2 billion worth of business. I'll give you another perfect example. And I know you know about this. This is the fake AV malware that, you know, used to pop up on people's computer. They'd be sitting there on a Windows box typing away, and they get a big red screen of death that says, you know, warning, you've got a virus. No matter what they try.
Interpol warning.
Right. Interpol warning, virus. And so they could pay or had to pay to get rid of that, like $49, and they would download a program that was called like Malware Defender 2000.
Yeah.
And what that would do is not what you weren't downloading antivirus, you were downloading virus, and that would infect your computer.
But how did they get that first pop-up on there? Where did that come from?
They were exploiting the browser. So they would go ahead and trick the browser.
They
get
so
they
pop-up. Find a website that has, in fact, this has happened to us, so I kind of know all about this. If we have, our website runs on a content management system called Drupal. It's written in PHP. We use some third-party modules. We didn't keep them up to date. Somebody discovered a flaw in them, just like you'd have a flaw in a Windows program or your operating system. And they used that flaw to put malware on our website.
You're not the only one. It's happened to Yahoo on their homepage, too. Yahoo, through its ad network, was serving up malware a couple of years ago.
It happens all the time.
Exactly. So they go after these big targets. So then they trick you into it. You put down your credit card. You've now downloaded the real malware. And the trick is you've also given your credit card to organized crime.
So that's important. We didn't have malware at first. We just had a pop-up.
That's right.
But we fell for it.
You fell for it. So it's social engineering. You were talking about Kevin Mitnick before. I mean, master social engineer.
Yeah.
There's some guy who tricks you into doing it. And people get tricked into participating in bank robberies without them knowing about it, to believing that Nigerian princes want to help them. Mm. And, you know, this type of stuff, too. And so I tell the story of an organized crime group called Intuitive Marketing, okay? So Interactive Marketing Solutions in the Ukraine. And they went out there, and these guys, that was their business.
Interactive Marketing Solutions.
Well, they were. I tell the story. If you go to their website, you can see them all listed on LinkedIn. You can see their positions. They're hiring. They're looking for SEO specialists to trick you to get this stuff. They were looking for Unix administrators. They had a call center that operated around the clock in French, Spanish, German, and English. And so the English one was run out of India. And the people that were working at the call centers didn't know that they were working.
Now, this is not them. Don't show this screen. I don't know if this is them. I think this is some poor fellow who used the same name.
Interactive Marketing in Kyiv, Ukraine.
Wow.
So when I presentations, like I show, like they have an org chart. If you go to the front desk, it's like a nice three-story building. They've got a receptionist, and their product was crimeware, right? And they were the ones that incentivized their employees. Eventually, after many years, they got taken down by the FBI and Interpol, and we added up the receipts for how much business they did, because to give that air of legitimacy, they were serving up receipts. In under 3 years, they did $500 million worth of sales of malware.
Wow.
So it's a fully organized crime network.
We know the crypto locker guys in a very short period of time did hundreds of millions of dollars. That was the malware that encrypted your data on your computer and said, hey, no problem, but for $300, we'll unlock it. And people were paying.
$300 in Bitcoin. Yeah,
It went up and down. Yeah.
They're actually doing that with for businesses that aren't online. I have a great image that I received from a law enforcement organization. They're actually sending out paper notices to small businesses. So for businesses that aren't online, dry cleaners, doctor's offices, pizza parlors in Buffalo, New York, are getting letters in the mail. And it says at the top, notice of extortion.
Organized
crime groups, they can just ship them out. And it says, we are going to rate you poorly on Yelp. We're going to do DDoS against your website. We're going to call in fake reports to the Department of Health alleging that there are like bugs in your food. And to avoid this, go ahead and just pay us in Bitcoin. And in case you don't know it, they give like a little QR code that you can scan and they'll teach you how to use Bitcoin so that you can pay the ransom. So it's all being automated. Software has become a crime.
It's pretty obvious when I do the Bitcoin or I pay, you know, I go down in 7-Eleven and get some money packs and I send it to the FBI that's where they're making money. But what about the guys who, you know, call from Microsoft and get some malware in my system or spearfish me? What happens then? The malware, I mean, are they looking for my credit card? What are they doing on my system?
Yeah, it's everything from credit card identity theft. They're taking your logins. They're selling it. There is a massive secondary market in stolen and illicit data. So, you know, we talk about the big data revolution. Everybody thinks, wow, big data is great. I can do big data analytics. But there's a flip side. Of course, you know Moore's Law. I jokingly made up Goodman's Law, which is the more data you're willing to store, the more organized crime is happy to consume, right? The more you keep, the more they'll steal. And, you know, it's kind of the new version of Willie Sutton. Willie Sutton, the big bank robber, when he was arrested by the FBI, they said, Willie, why do you rob banks? And he says, well, that's where the money is. Where's the money today? It's in the data. So they're monetizing that data.
We also heard about big botnets and your computer being co-opted and joining a botnet. And then what happens then?
Well, those botnets can be used either for organized crime groups or even by nation states. So one of the big things that has changed in botnets, those used to be based upon individual computers getting infected. But, you know, frankly, your crappy old Pentium PC only has got so much power. Now what criminals are taking on to do is they're actually going after the cloud. So they are renting space on Amazon, AWS,
oh,
and
no.
using tremendous power to do denial of service.
They're using EC2 for denial of of service attacks.
They are. And for serving up malware, I think 16%, don't quote me, it was something between 16 and 32% of today's malware is served up by AWS because it gives an air of legitimacy. They're using front companies to go ahead and store all that stuff on
there.
And
if you get shut down, it's easy to spin another instance up.
Exactly. Very, very easy to do. And so the Iranians, we were talking about them earlier, they did that big denial of service attack against the American financial service industry about a year or so ago against Bank of America, Citibank, Chase, all the major American firms. And for about 48 hours, people couldn't access the websites of these banks. And it turns out that by harnessing the cloud and using these third-party cloud vendors, they were able to go ahead and generate 70 gigabits of data per second in a DDoS attack, right? That's like state-level crazy amount of data that they're throwing at these banks. So the cloud can be weaponized as well.
Yeah, we've talked a lot on Security Now about amplification attacks using NNTP and other servers, and it's very easy for somebody on a dial-up modem, in effect, to create a giant DDoS attack because of flaws in various things. Well, most recently in cheap consumer-grade routers and just massing a bunch of routers to attack. I have to say I feel a little bit despairing when you hear about, for instance, the Sands Casino hack. This was an Iranian hacker who got into didn't like the fact that Shelly Adelson, the owner of the Sands Casinos, was such a supporter of Israel. Now, you've got to figure a casino, the back-end operation of a casino is the most protected cyberspace in the world. I mean, Shelly's got money to hire the best. How could they still get hacked?
You'd like to think so. I tell a story in the book of the Crown Casino in Melbourne, Australia. A man went into the casino, played for a day and a half, played poker against the house, and walked away a day and a half later with $33 million bucks just by playing. He was supposed to be a whale, came in from Asia, and the casino was stunned. They couldn't figure out what happened. Turns out he was part of an organized crime group. They hacked the IP cameras in the casino.
Wow.
So they used the casino's own security network to see what he had, what the dealer had, what the other players had. And they were measuring all of this in real time. And they were talking into an earpiece in his head, telling him when to bet. So casinos and all these, these cameras, these security systems that are supposed to protect us, they're just other computers that can be hacked as well.
I mean, Shelly is the 22nd richest man in the world. And if he can't keep his computers protected, what are we going to do?
Probably heard that the State Department closed down their email network for months. They've been trying to chase people out of their networks. This is the U.S. Department of State. They have all the access to the resources of the United States government. And they had to not solve it. The way they solved it is by turning it off so people who work at state don't have email.
Sony, another example. Now, here's a company that got hacked, but they couldn't care less about cybersecurity. So, of course, they got hacked. It looked like a political. Do you think it was North Korea that did it? Was it political?
It's a great question. I did an interview with The Economist talking about Sony. Sony is an excellent victim. They are really, really good at being victims of cyber attacks. You would have thought after the Sony PlayStation hack back in 2011, they might have invested some resources into this somehow. You might not want to store 47,000 employee passwords in a document called passwords.doc and store that unencrypted on your hard drive. So they just make bad mistakes over and over. To your question about it being North Korea, the president and the director of the FBI have both come out and said that it is North Korea. I have not seen the classified data, so I cannot make an assessment. But what I will say is this. I find it incredibly difficult to believe that they acted alone for the following reason. If you think about somebody who grows up in North Korea, they have very little access to the outside world. And if you look at the bits of data that were selectively released, like allegedly the racist jokes between Sony executives and the favorite film list of the president only involving black films, there's no way that a North Korean alone would have the cultural understanding to figure out, oh, this will be embarrassing to his political party. Oh, racism would be bad. They just don't have that understanding within their system, within their network. Somebody had to explain that to them. So I'm not saying they couldn't have done it technically, but the cultural understanding, the things that were released, doesn't add up for me.
And though it's not hard to imagine that there are hackers for hire all over the world, and if you're a state and you've got a few hundred million lying around, you probably can get anything you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't even need to have a few hundred million. In Future Crimes, I tell the story of a group called Hidden Links. These are Chinese People Liberation officers who during the day hack on behalf of the government. They've received government training. They've got government tools, but they're making PLA officer level salaries. So at nighttime, they moonlight. Right. They started their own hacker for hire organization. And you can have state level hackers with state level tools that you can hire to go after you.
Of course, the largest hack institution in the United States is probably our own National Security Agency.
I'm sorry, what are they called? I haven't heard of them. Yeah.
They have probably quite a few people, very smart mathematicians. I know they do. Many people I know have been approached by the NSA because we're in a battle. We're in a war. But you say that maybe the best way to fight this is not to get in a war over it. So let's talk about some solutions.
Sure.
In a little bit. Not yet. Right. I got to do snacks first. Would you like a snack?
You got it. Yes, please.
You said you liked donuts?
Allegedly.
Stop. Stop the insanity. No more donuts. We've got something much better. We've got Nature Box snacks. These are snacks that are mailed right to you. You get a Nature Box every month, or in our case, like 10. Because our staff loves them every month. They're nutritionist approved. Never any high fructose corn syrup, trans fats, artificial colors, artificial flavors. Only good stuff. They come in resealable bags. That's also good for you. You can just have a little taste and move on. Although when it's jalapeno flavored cashews, that may be hard to do. Or fancy dried figs. The dried fruit from Nature Box is amazing. The pineapple. And by the way, what are the ingredients of dried figs? Figs. There's no sulfites, nothing in here. Cherry, vanilla, granola. You've got savory, you've got spicy, you've got sweet. They also have snacks. There's hundreds of them that are gluten-free, or if you're, you can't have, I can't remember what it is. There's all sorts of vegan. There's all sorts of snacks for dietary needs. Look, here's what I want you to do. We're going to get you a sampler. All you have to do is go to naturebox.com/twit. We'll send you a free 5-snack sampler. These are their 5 most popular snacks. $2 shipping and handling. That's it. Once you taste it, once you understand, I can pretty much guarantee you will want to order a box. And they're shipped to your door. They're fresh. They're delicious. They're Nature Box. We love them. You will, too. And don't go to the snack machine. Don't go to the donut shop. Just go to your Nature Box. They're nutritionist approved. Orange apple fruit chews. How about antioxidant boost? It's a mix of roasted nuts, dried fruit, and dark chocolate. Naturebox.com/twit. Get your free snack today. Try it out. I think you'll like it. The book Future Crimes, the author Mark Goodman. He's done it all from a street beat for the LAPD. And thanks to your amazing adept abilities with WordPerfect, cybercrime expert who worked as the futurist in residence with the FBI, senior advisor to Interpol. He's the founder of the Future Crimes Institute, the chair for policy, law, and ethics at the Singularity University, Singularity University is very cool in Silicon Valley. Are you in Silicon Valley? Where are you located?
Yeah, I split my time between there and L.A., but I teach up at Singularity University a couple of times a month. You should come by and visit us.
I've always meant to. Yeah, some great people there. Many of the people we've had on this show, actually. So, it's obvious. Anybody who's been watching any of our programming for the last 10 years, if you watch Security Now, you know the bad guys have almost an infinite supply of tools with which to attack us. Many motivations, political, financial. How do we fight this? It seems like an insurmountable odds.
Well, don't go on the internet. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, no, that's bad. I can't do that.
Social media is bad. Anything that you plug to the wall or takes a battery.
Thank you very much, Mark Goodman. It's been great talking to you. No, that's obviously not your recommendation.
That is not my answer. You know what? Even though I see and for 20 years have been dealing with the downside of technology, you know, I've been arresting people and dealing with this issue in more than 70 different countries, I'm still a technophile. I love technology. I think it's awesome. Technology, as you'll probably hear from Peter Diamantis in the next couple of weeks, it's going to bring 2 billion people out of poverty. It's going to radically extend life, reduce infant mortality. I think technology is going to be awesome.
It will radically improve
our lives. Absolutely. Yeah. We all agree on that. The question is, how can we use it safely and securely to the best possible extent? There's 2 ways to look at it. One is, what can the individual do? And in Future Crimes, I created something called the Update Protocol. It's based upon research by the Australian Ministry of Defense. They studied over 100,000 network attacks, and they basically broke it down, and they said, if you do these few things, you can reduce your cyber threat risk by 85%.
Wow.
So I've created the Update Protocol. If you go to futurecrimes.com, there's a free infographic I'll be happy to send you. But there it lays out the steps about passwords, encryption, updating your software, watching what you download, etc. So just that alone can make a huge difference. There is no such thing as perfect security, right? If you've got a nice BMW and you park it in a bad neighborhood with the windows down, the keys in the ignition, and $10,000 cash on the front seat, you won't be surprised when that car is stolen. But even if you park it like in Beverly Hills and in a nice neighborhood and it's locked and it's got LoJack, somebody can still come by with a tow truck and take your car away. So we're not looking for perfect security. We just want to teach people how to protect themselves in cyberspace. We know when you go to work in the morning, you don't leave your front door to your apartment or your house wide open. I'm trying to teach people how to do the same thing in cyberspace, and these very 6 simple steps will do it. On the grander scale, what do we need to do to kind of help reduce these broader cyber risks from nation states, organized criminals, and hacktivists? One of the big things I mentioned earlier is the opportunity to take less of a law enforcement approach to the risk and more of an epidemiological
approach. I love the public health idea. I think that's exactly right.
We have a well-functioning World Health Organization, a Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Why not a CDC for cyber or something along those lines? I also think nature's got 4 billion years of experience, building immune systems. What can we learn from that? I also think, and this might be of particular interest to your listeners, Leo, is that we need to get average everyday citizens involved in this, right? The old method of the cops was stand back, police tape, we're in charge, police line, do not cross. That doesn't work anymore. We are short 1 million cybersecurity professionals around the world, and we're going to need more. We've got Reserve Army, Reserve Marines, we've got Reserve Police, we've got FEMA for natural disasters. Who's going to protect us in time of cyber disaster? We're going to need a National Cyber Reserve Corps of experts. Doesn't matter if they're 9-year-old kids or 80-year-old grandmothers, as long as they've got the expertise. But the time to vet these people, clear them, and get them prepared is now, before that big cyber so-called 9/11 occurs. My concern is that we're not taking the threat seriously enough. We need to get much more serious about this. One of the things I'm doing is I'm working with Peter Diamantis and the XPRIZE Foundation. We're hoping to create a $20 million XPRIZE for cybersecurity. So let's see who can build that more resilient software, that more resilient operating system, so that we can, reduce the threat. The goal is not perfect security, it's not perfect software, but make a big difference. And the last thing that I think we need is a Manhattan Project for cybersecurity. If we go back to World War II and think about, the potential of the Nazis getting a nuclear bomb before the Allies, we understood that that was an existential threat to the United States and to the Western world. And so we worked really hard on this Manhattan Project. We had 120,000 allies working around the clock in secret, trying to make sure that we were able to develop that technology. I think a Manhattan Project for cyber is very much called for. Not that it needs to be run by the military or even the government, but we need somebody to get intentional about this. And we need to think about it, right? Because what runs the modern society? It is technology. Now, I'm not comparing, a technology to a nuke, right? Obviously, a nuke going off is a very, very serious thing. But our technology drives our modern lives. It is our electrical grids, our water, our power. It is 911 systems, electronic health records, air traffic control, in the future, self-driving cars. It's all run by computers. And when they fail, we don't have a backup plan. I think the time to build that and to be intentional about it is now. I strongly believe that technology can be awesome. I quote in the book President Kennedy, who said in the 1960s, by the end of this decade, we're going to put a man on the moon. And we did that. Think about how phenomenal that task was. and we accomplished it. So surely we can have more secure cyberspace. We can have more secure technology. We can have that awesome, brighter future that we all want out of our own tech. We just need to be intentional about it, and I think the time to act is now, and that's what Future Crimes is all about, Leo.
I love this book because you have very extensive notes and bibliography, and you also have in the appendix this update protocol. People can also find it at futurecrimes.com, and it's stuff I've been saying for years on the radio show. It's stuff we say all the time. Steve Gibson has taught me. It's update, UPDATE, update frequently, password hygiene. Don't use the same password. Use LastPass or a password management program. Use two-factor authentication. Do not download software from untrusted parties. Be very skeptical. Do not run as admin. I hope people get your book and do this because this is so great. You go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the one that even folks that are very technologically savvy sometimes miss, is that when you're running your box in admin mode, then that gives the malware all the permissions they need to run. So, you know, if you're not running in admin mode and you get like, hey, I need admin access, that's a clue. And when you're talking about software, like if your flashlight app asks for access to your location and, you know, your contacts, I joke in the book, why does my flashlight need access to my location? I'm in the dark. That's where I'm located. That's all you need to know. You should turn on. You're a flashlight.
It should stay in the dark.
In law enforcement, we call those clues.
I think Steve and I talked about a report because he's one of the people who's really advocating not running as a super user or root or admin, that 85% of Internet Explorer exploits would be eliminated if you were not running as admin. If you're running as a standard user or a limited user, they just don't work. And that's fabulous. You know, that's an easy thing to do. Turn off. This is an interesting one, and I have not been recommending this. Turn off your computer or your internet connection when you're not using it.
The reason why I recommend that is, and it's also true for mobiles, is, as I mentioned earlier, the crimeware is fully automated. So they're coming and knocking at your door all the time, trying to get in through your various ports, looking for vulnerabilities in your software. If when you sleep, you just have your computer off, you've cut for those 8 hours, you know, your cyber risk by 33%. If you don't want to reboot the computer, just turn off the Wi-Fi or pull the LAN cable. And the same is true on your mobile, particularly with the, not saying you should turn off your mobile phone, but with the extra ports. Most people walk around airports, universities, you know, coffee shops, and they've got Wi-Fi on, RFID, near field communication, you know, personal hotspot. All these ports are wide open. Their location is being broadcasted all time. And so now they run into more and more privacy threats. Companies are starting to look at that. They're looking at the MAC addresses on your Wi-Fi. Nordstrom got into a lot of trouble because they were tracking people in their stores with that. So just keep the ports open. Keep the ports closed if you're not using them and turn them on when you need them.
My iPhone yesterday said, you know, you've installed this, it's a Verizon iPhone, you've installed this Verizon app to keep track, as I had, of my data usage and bill. And it said, you know, it's checking your location all the time. And then Verizon stuck a little ad in. Next time you're at a Verizon store, we'll know you're there and you won't have to check in. And I thought, yeah, I'm turning that off. Finally, the update encrypt. I love this. Use a File Vault or BitLocker or TrueCrypt or VPN. SSL went everywhere. This in a way is public health, isn't it? If everybody does this, I think people don't realize that a hacked computer is not only bad for you, it's bad for the internet. That when you're 100%. Infected, you're a vector for infection. So stop it.
I joke in the book, you know, people think their grandparents might not be particularly tech savvy, but you got to give grandma credit. You know, she's participating in a botnet, right? So she has to be a little bit sophisticated.
She's smarter than you think.
Exactly. No, the joke about that is you're exactly right. It comes down to hygiene, and that's why I talk about both public health epidemiology and cyber hygiene. If you sneeze, right, you know to cover your mouth. You don't go and shake somebody's hand. We know what hygiene looks like in real space, but we don't know in cyberspace. So we share USB thumb drives, and you know that, of course, is a big attack vector as well. So just by keeping your technology clean, the files that you share and download, etc., you can help keep other people safe and secure as well.
You talk about this Manhattan Project, and you're talking about the book efforts to create a truly secure operating system. That would be a worthwhile project.
Absolutely. It might be the most worthwhile project of our time. Yeah. Right now, we don't have trustworthy computing. We see things appear on our screens all the time, and right. we believe them. I know you've talked about the Stuxnet attack previously. That's how the Iranians got fooled, even though the uranium centrifuges were spinning out of control. On their screens, it said everything was green and fine. We've had a hacked GPS. You probably heard about, you know, the yacht, the $80 million yacht that was hijacked because they spoofed the GPS off of it. So I talk about that in the book. So all the screens around us can be completely faked. What we see on a doctor's screen, right? You could hack into a hospital and change somebody's blood type. You can change the algorithm under which somebody trades. So we don't have trustworthy computing. We don't have secure computing. We don't have resilient computing. And we don't have trustworthy computing. And yet we're building our modern world completely on computers. So the computers are awesome. Let's keep them. But let's figure out a way to make them more secure, trustworthy, and lock them down so we can all benefit from this tech.
You don't say this, but I think some of the blame goes to our own government, because unfortunately there is a conflict between the need for security, the need for privacy, the need for encryption, and law enforcement's need to break privacy, break encryption, to get at bad guys. And what the NSA has done, and what we now know about what the NSA has done, thanks to Edward Snowden, has, I believe, is in direct conflict with our goal to protect ourselves, to be, it isn't in the NSA's interest. And it has a secondary effect, which I really fear. You mentioned it. In order to get the smart people who are watching, the kids coming out of college who are adept at this stuff, to do the right thing and to work for law enforcement, to work for making this a better world, a better place, they're going to become cynical. Because of the kinds of things the NSA is up to, they don't trust government. They've lost their interest in public service. And I fear that those are the kids who are most at risk of going over to the dark side and becoming our enemies.
Well, I talk about that actually in the book, believe it or not. There's a few different points I reference it. So I started out to write a book on the future of crime. I was going to talk about criminals and terrorists and, you know, criminal hackers. And what I realized as I got into it and I start out the early chapters is recognizing the role of both corporations and governments, corporations, particularly social media companies, that drive the creation of all of this data that eventually gets leaked and used against us, either because it's their exact business model to do that or because, you know, the companies are being hacked. And then, of course, the governments as well. And I do talk about the NSA in the book. And I say that they're a conflicted organization because they're dual-hatted. People think the NSA is the organization that spies both on people overseas, whether it be terrorists, foreign governments, or even domestically, there's that concern post-Snowden. But people don't realize that besides being offensive in their operations, the NSA has a second equally important mandate, which is to be defensive. The NSA is tasked with protecting the computer infrastructure of the United States. And so they are a schizophrenic organization because the people that go on the offensive operations don't want to plug the zero days. They don't want to plug those holes in Windows and browsers and Flash and Adobe Acrobat because those are the exact tools that they exploit to get at their targets overseas. But by keeping those exploits open and available and not protecting them, the defensive part of the organization is losing those arguments, and that means we're all at risk. So I think that you can have both security and privacy and encryption and have it all. I really do.
Yeah, the NSA actually publishes among the best security configuration guides anywhere. I mean, they're really good for every operating system. It is conflicted because on the one hand, they want you to protect yourself. On the other, they don't want criminals to protect themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's a challenge we all have to face. And I think this is a great way to start your journey. Future Crimes. Mark Goodman has been our guest. The book is available now from Doubleday, but there is an Audible version, there's an audiobook version, there's a Kindle version, and of course you can get the hardcover if you're old-fashioned and you want to get off the internet. Thank you, Mark. What a pleasure. A really great topic.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine. All right. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you for being here. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC on twit.tv. I love it if you watch live. The chat room is a great benefit to me. The questions, the thoughts that you guys generate really help me a lot. But if you can't be here live, don't worry about that. You can always watch on demand. After the fact, audio and video available at twit.tv/TRI, youtube.com/triangulation, You could subscribe in your favorite podcatcher on your mobile device or on iTunes or the Xbox Music. And, of course, you can use our Twit apps. There's apps for all the operating systems, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Roku, Macintosh, Windows. And that's not because of us. I thank our independent developers who are just Twit fans who've written it. We thank our Twit community always for the chat room, for the apps, for everything you guys do. Thanks for being here. Hey, we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.